Welcome back to another deep dive. Today we are sitting up and stepping directly onto a battlefield. But we aren't talking about tanks or trenches or anything like that. We're talking about the invisible war happening right behind your screen, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
It really is a war zone.
Yeah.
It's just one made entirely of code and, well, psychology.
And looking at the stack of notes and research we have in front of us, it's honestly a little terrifying. We aren't just talking about sophisticated algorithms here. We're talking about psychological manipulation, literal zombie armies of computers, and the laws that are trying, sometimes desperately, to keep order in what feels like a digital Wild West.
That's a great way to frame it. The sources we're looking at today are very comprehensive. We're going to cover the absolute fundamentals of IT security. So we're looking at the psychology of the people trying to break in, the specific weapons they use, the malware, and then, you know, the physical and legal shields we have to protect ourselves.
Right. And the mission for this deep dive is pretty specific, isn't it? We want to move you from being just a passive user of technology, someone who just clicks remind me later on those updates and, you know, hopes for the best. We want you to become an informed digital citizen, to understand the why behind those annoying password prompts and all the strict workplace rules.
Exactly. It's about understanding the ecosystem you live in so you aren't just a sitting duck.
I have to admit, looking through these notes, the term that immediately jumped out at me was zombie devices.
Mm.
I mean, it sounds like something out of a B movie, not a computer science textbook.
It does, doesn't it? But it's a very real, very technical concept. We'll definitely get to the zombies. But for me, what's really fascinating in this research is it's the gray area. We often think of cybersecurity as black and white, good guys versus bad guys. But the sources highlight this really murky middle ground of hacker ethics and the surprisingly physical nature of data.
Physical nature? You mean like smashing things?
Sometimes. I mean, did you know that to truly delete data from certain hard drives, just hitting delete isn't enough? You basically need a giant industrial strength magnet to scramble the physics of the drive itself.
See, I thought dragging it to the trash bin was enough. Clearly, I have a lot to learn. Okay,
yes.
Let's unpack this properly. Let's start with the players on the field, the hackers.
The human element.
Mm.
Right. Now, when I think of a hacker, I picture the stereotype. You know the one. A guy in a hoodie in a dark basement, green code reflecting on his glasses, typing furiously.
Break into the Pentagon, yeah.
Exactly. But the reality is a bit more nuanced, isn't it? The source material breaks them down into three color-coded categories.
It uses the hat terminology, which actually comes from old Westerns. Bad guys wore black hats, good guys wore white. So, starting with the villains, you have your black hat hackers.
And these are the ones fitting the stereotype.
Largely, yes. Their defining characteristic is malicious intent. They are trying to gain unauthorized access to computer systems, to networks. Their goals are usually theft, stealing credit card info, corporate secrets, or just causing damage for the sake of it.
And the notes mentioned they often work for organized crime rings.
That's a huge part of it now. It's a business. This isn't just mischief anymore. It's a multi-billion dollar industry. They steal data to sell it. This is the strictly illegal side.
Okay, so that's the clear bad guy. Then on the flip side, we have the white hat hackers.
The white hats. These are the ethical hackers. Now, here's the interesting thing. They use the exact same tools and techniques as the black hats. They're just as skilled. They run the same code.
So what makes them the good guys?
One word. Permission. White hat hackers try to find vulnerabilities in systems, but they have the owner's explicit agreement to do it. Companies actually hire them, essentially as digital security guards, to break into their own systems, find the weak spots, and report them so they can be fixed before a black hat finds them.
So they're hired guns, but legal ones.
Precisely. It's legal because of that authorization.
Okay, so black hat is bad and illegal. White hat is good and legal. But then there's this third category. The gray hat hacker. This is where it gets really interesting to me and, frankly, a little confusing.
It is the most complex one, yeah. Emotionally and legally. Gray hat hackers are, well, they're walking a fine line. Like black hats, they're trying to gain access to systems. But like white hats, they often don't have malicious intent. They might just be doing it for the intellectual challenge, or maybe they just enjoy the thrill of discovering vulnerabilities.
So they aren't trying to steal your bank details or crash your server.
Generally, no. They usually don't exploit the vulnerabilities they find. They might even email the company afterwards and say, hey, I found a hole in your wall. You should probably patch that.
That sounds helpful. I mean, if someone told me my front door was unlocked, I'd say, thank you. Why is this considered gray?
Because, and if you take nothing else away from this segment, take this. They do not have permission.
And that's the deal breaker.
That is the deal breaker. Even if you break into a system just to prove you can, or even if you break in to leave a helpful note, the act of hacking without permission is illegal. The law doesn't necessarily look at your intent to be nice. It looks at your lack of authorization.
That is a huge aha moment for me. The defining line between legal and illegal isn't just being mean, it's having an invitation.
Think of it this way. You can't pick the lock on your neighbor's front door and walk into their living room, even if your only intention was to leave a note saying, your lock is easy to pick. You're still breaking and entering.
That really puts it in perspective. You can't just vigilante your way through other people's servers. Okay, so we know who they are. Now let's talk about their weapons, the arsenal of threats. How do they actually get in? The notes mention something called a denial of service, or DOS attack.
A DOS attack is. It's a brute force method. Not subtle at all. Imagine a server, like the computer hosting a website, is like a shop with one front door.
Okay, I'm picturing a shop.
A DOS attack is like sending 1,000 people to crowd that door all at once. They aren't going to buy anything. They're just standing there, jamming the entryway.
So legitimate customers, the real traffic, can't get in.
Exactly. The server spends so much time trying to process these fake requests or just dealing with the traffic jam that it either crashes or becomes completely unusable for the real users.
It's a digital blockade.
Precisely.
And then we get to malware. The sources list quite a few flavors here. I feel like in pop culture, people use terms like virus and worm interchangeably, but looking at these notes, they are actually mechanically different.
Well, they're very different. And the distinction really matters for how you treat them. Malware is just the umbrella term for malicious software. But let's take viruses versus worms.
Help me out here. What is the actual technical difference?
Okay, so a virus is a program that attaches itself to a file or a document. Mm. But the key mechanism is that it needs you, the user, to do something. It replicates by tricking you into running it or opening that infected file. It needs a host to travel.
Okay, so a virus needs me to make a mistake. It needs a ride.
Right, but a worm is much scarier. A worm is standalone software. It doesn't need a host file. And importantly, it doesn't need you to click anything.
So how does it move?
It crawls through the network all on its own. It scans for vulnerabilities in the operating system, exploits them, copies itself to the new machine, and then just repeats. It can spread exponentially without any human intervention.
That is terrifying. It's like an autonomous weapon.
Effectively, yes. Then you have Trojans, named after the Trojan horse, of course.
Hiding inside the GIF.
Exactly. It hides inside what looks like standard, legitimate software. You download a game or a helpful utility tool, but hidden inside the code is a malicious payload. Once you install the gift, the Trojan opens a back door into your system.
And once that door is open, that's when the really nasty stuff can walk in.
Correct. That back door is often used to deploy something like ransomware.
This is the one we hear about in the news constantly.
Because it's where the money is. Ransomware is digital kidnapping. It encrypts your data, locks it up mathematically, and then demands a fee, usually in cryptocurrency, to decrypt it.
And then there's the spy stuff. Spyware and adware.
Spyware is insidious. It runs quietly in the background, just watching and recording your activity, your keystrokes, websites you visit. It's trying to capture passwords or banking info. Adware is generally less dangerous, but incredibly annoying. It just floods you with intrusive pop-ups that are hard to turn off.
Now, earlier you teased the zombies. The notes mention botnets.
Right. This brings us back to that DOS attack we mentioned, the shop with the blocked door. How does one hacker get 1,000 computers to flood a server? They don't own 1,000 computers, they use yours.
Mine.
Well, maybe. If your computer is infected with certain malware, it can become part of a botnet, a robot network. The hacker controls it remotely without you knowing. Your computer becomes a zombie, mindlessly following orders to attack other targets while you're just trying to check your email.
So I could be un-